That's an unusual for. Can I get everyone's please take their seats, and we'll start the meeting. Okay, we'll bring the meeting to order now. Okay, well, the meeting will now come to order. Seven after, and we'll start with a roll call. Rob Miller?
Here.
John Brady?
Present.
John Fouché?
Here.
Bob Simonson?
Here.
Russ Westman?
Here.
David Dubink?
Here.
Dan Berman?
Here.
Maria Kelly?
Here.
Marshall Ohilsky said he will be late if he can make it. Jim Furman is not here. On his way, okay. Rob Scheip, Karen Vandetti is out of town, and Lee Ferraro, I don't know. Okay.
He had an issue.
Oh. Okay. So we have a quorum, and a sole representative of financial for a while. Okay, welcome everyone to the May meeting of the Wastewater Technical Advisory Committee. On our agenda this evening, we have two technical memorandums to review. The first one on our agenda is titled Effluent Reuse and Disposal Alternatives. The second will be partially mixed facultative pond options. As we did in our last meeting, each item will be introduced by the project team, then discussed by the TAC prior to taking public comment. We understand that the issue of effluent reuse is extremely important to the community, especially considering our Level 3 water severity conditions. However, it is also important to understand the practical limits and costs associated with the treatment and disposal of the effluent. In order to deliver the effluent for reuse to users in the prohibition zone, it requires higher levels of treatment. The higher the level, the greater the cost. To accomplish this, the project needs to rely on the active participation of the three water purveyors in Los Osos. Please keep this in mind if you're going to speak in public comment. The TMs that we discuss our responses to the project team to information, requests, or questions raised by the independent EIR team. Our task is to review, question, and comment on the content of those TMs, especially as it pertains to the effects we believe it might have on Los Osos. Those of you who might wish to comment during the public comment period should restrict your comments to the contents of each tech memo. If you believe that there is an alternative solution to the topic under discussion, you should submit that information directly to the project team at lowwp@co.slo.ca.us. In order for us to get through our agenda and adjourn by 9:30, I need to ask you to abide by these rules. I would also like to remind everyone listening to us this evening that included in the calculations for designing our wastewater project is a drop in the current per-family water usage. Although the Board of Supervisors passed ordinances designed to retrofit plumbing fixtures in the community, no program will be effective enough without voluntary water conservation measures taken by individuals. We can immediately have an effect on our groundwater basin by flushing toilets less frequently, monitoring our use of showers, and for a relatively low cost, install a hot water recirculation system. Also, teach your children water conservation. A reminder that the TAC report on the TMs discussed in our April meeting have been submitted to the EIR team and are published on the website. The next meeting of the TAC will be held on Monday, June 9th. Before we start our agenda, I would like to ask the project team to update the community on the current progress of the draft EIR. And that's going to be you, John? Okay. Faintly.
There we go. Other switch. Thank you.
John Waddell.
Thank you, Mr. Garfinkel. I'm John Waddell with County Public Works. Just before we, Mark is going to give an update on the EIR. Also, I have a couple of slides of kind of the overall project schedule. But before that, I just want to say we have a proposal, and we're processing it to retain NWRI, the National Water Research Institute, to do a peer review, and including with Dr. George Chabaniglis as chair of the panel. They will be reviewing Corollo Engineers' work to date, which would include the rough and fine screening reports, as well as the tech memos that you're currently reviewing. And would expect to have their panel report probably around midsummer. And so this will complement, you know, the work that the TAC has been doing and is doing in both, you know, the pro-con report and also the TAC and the public's input and comments on these tech memos. So it's going to be an additional level of review from an expert peer review panel.
That sounds like good news and what the community's been asking for. Thank you.
Yes.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mark Hutchinson, Department of Public Works Environmental Division. The EIR team is almost completed. The field work associated with sites east of town, as you recall, there are a number of areas out there that have not been addressed in previous reports. So there's been a concerted effort with springtime and the flowering plants to get our biologists out in the field on a number of different sites. They've been accompanied sometimes on the same trip and sometimes separately by the cultural resources team. Again, looking at areas that have not, if you can believe that, not ever been previously surveyed for any project, let alone for a wastewater project. With that, I do want to remind everyone that we've been getting a couple of questions from members of the public, landowners especially, pointing out that the areas we're surveying were not addressed in the fine screening report. So I want to remind everybody that at the time we did the fine screening report, we noted that the EIR would necessarily have to cast a much wider net than what we saw in fine screening. So we're certainly not limiting our investigation from the environmental perspective to only those sites and areas that were initially addressed in fine screening. So you may hear from folks who have that same comment that they're not seeing, they don't see a match between where the survey crews are and what the fine screening report addressed. But again, reminding everyone to make sure that we have full coverage of alternatives and sites and good knowledge any potential site for whatever part of the project it might be. We do have folks in the field who are out there on sites, again, east of town. 99.9% of the document review has been done. That's where we've reviewed and cataloged as many previous reports as we could locate. A great many of those are excellent reports and still valid for today, so we don't have a lot of repeat work to do there. We are at this time also engaging conversations with numerous regulatory agencies, and as you know, there are many. That's the part of the CEQA process where you follow up on their letters that they submitted in the notice of preparation. You make contact with their contact people, update them on the project, and get a detailed read of where they are and what sort of regulations may have come up in the interim that we need to address. That is the major source of our work at this time that we have any completion on. There are, by the way, a couple of sites out east of town that we've yet to visit, and we're scheduling those now. So if there's someone listening who expected the crew to be out there, they're on their way, you will be contacted. Don't give up hope, we'll be there. I'm sitting down in the next couple of weeks with the EIR consultant team to look at initial work products, and direction, review some of the issues that we naturally come up as we do these investigations, to chart out some of the details of the EIR path. And a major component of that is to review the schedule to see if we're going to stay with our current schedule, if we're going to stretch it or shrink it, how we're going to deal with that. It's always a balance between time and amount of information that we can present. We want to have the best mix of that so that when the draft EIR comes out on the street, it's complete, but also that we don't overdo it and spend too much time getting it to a certain point. With that, I'll give it back to John to talk a little bit about schedule and some design build issues.
Thank you very much, Mark.
What I have here on the overhead are two slides from a recent board meeting. So these are slides that have you may have seen before, and they are already on our website from our April board meeting. And of course, they'll be included with the minutes of this TAC meeting. As the title, Design Build Strategy and Approach, and also includes how it relates to the environmental impact report. We are, you know, currently developing our approach and strategy and looking at, you know, the many aspects of design build contracting. Essentially, the process, there's a separate independent technical review panel that is part of the design build process. We need to put out an RFP for that panel and bring them on board. And this is separate from the peer review that the NWRI team is doing in these next couple months. They could certainly, if they were interested, be considered for this panel. But in initial conversations with them, they've indicated that this type of panel is not what they do. The peer review is more of along the lines of what they do. But anyways, selecting that panel is a formal RFP process. And then as far as the design build contracting, it's a two-step process. An RFP is request for proposals. RFQ is, in the design build process, the initial step, putting out a formal request for qualifications. Design build teams submit their qualifications, and then those are evaluated, and then the shortlisted, so the most qualified teams then move on to the proposal stage. During this whole process, we also would be working to develop the request for proposals, the actual contract documents and preliminary designs that would need to go into a request for proposals to actually seek design build contracts. All of this we anticipate working on before the release of the draft EIR. In other words, to get those design build teams on board as early in the process as possible, and then the developing of a draft request for proposals is a parallel effort. Another thing that is we're working on and expect to release in early summer is an initial aerial photo survey of properties and sending a photo of every property in the prohibition zone to the property owners and asking the question of where on their property, and assuming in the front yards, they would like to see a step tank placed. So assuming that it is a step collection system is implemented and chosen as the project, this is essentially a preliminary design. You know, one of the functions it serves is preliminary design and identifying where these septic tanks would go on front yards. And then that information would then be available to the design build proposers so that they would have that to, you know, to look at as they were developing their bids and seeing where people would prefer to have their septic tanks. That also serves the purpose of getting property owners to think about that very question of where would these tanks go in their yards and their front yards. So we expect to have that out in the early summer, late June, early July is what we're shooting for. Mark was talking about the schedule and the anticipated release of the draft EIR in early September is what we have scheduled now. After the release of the draft EIR, on that process, there's a minimum 45 days public comment period before you can adopt the final EIR. But there are a number of other steps at the bottom of your screen that also need to happen, which we anticipate going beyond the 45 days, because in addition to the public comment period, this fall, around September, after the draft EIR comes out, is when we plan to release the community advisory survey, which is a much more extensive survey that covers many aspects of the project and goes out to the entire community. And it should be noted that where the aerial photo survey, which is a question of step tanks on properties, would be sent to property owners, the community advisory survey would go to the entire community. Would include property owners, residents who would essentially be renters, business owners, and it would be to areas of the community that are outside the prohibition zone. For example, areas east of town that potentially could be impacted by a treatment plant in that area. So they would also receive a survey. The results you got the environmental analysis and community advisory survey results. We expect would both be implemented into a selection model for design-build proposals. So with the approach we're developing, would anticipate releasing the request for proposals for design-build after the draft EIR comes out, having those proposals and design-build projects submitted, and then selecting the best value project. And then all of these would then go into the boxes on the right of your screen, where you kind of they don't all happen at the same time, but around the adoption of the final EIR, around that time frame, is when you would award design build contracts, selection of the project, and the final EIR. And again, the Board of Supervisors would make the final project decisions on certifying the EIR, the notice of determination, and in selecting the project, while considering the results of the community advisory survey, the design build contracts, and the draft EIR and their public comments. Now, on the community advisory survey, there's been we've talked about it at the TAC also, the idea of having a survey before the design build proposals are submitted. And we feel that a well-crafted survey from a professional survey firm can establish price sensitivity to certain options, and that can be part of the decision. But in the end, if the results of the community survey and the submitted design build proposals are inconclusive on which project to recommend to the Board of Supervisors, there is the option for another element of a survey where, I could foresee if it's down to two or three projects and the results of the survey are inconclusive and the prices on the design build proposals are within a range, at that point it could be even a simple question, A, B, or C, which project do you prefer? Could go a follow-up survey of the community if the results are inconclusive. But primarily the main community advisory survey is going to ask the majority of the more component focused questions as far as site and technology and collection system. And again, that is expected to be released after the draft EIR. I think that covers it. The EIR and design phases is kind of a two-year process, and characterizes environmental work in 2008, design in 2009, and we recognize that the environmental process most likely would take more than a year, whereas the design would likely take less than a year. So the EIR there's a chance it would push into 2009 before that was finaled, but overall we still expect a two-year process for environmental and design, finishing around the end of 2009. So then we expect construction to begin in 2010.
Thank you very much, Mr. Waddell. And with that, we'll begin our agenda items. Go ahead, Rob.
I had a couple questions. On the RFQs, The list of companies that submit RFQs, will that list be made public prior to the request for RFPs?
Yes, I believe that would be.
I figured it would. I just wanted to make sure. The aerial photos with the questionnaire that's sent out, will it include what will be required to hook up to a step tank, and like the electrical connections, any possible downtime if someone just plans on putting it in the same spot where their current tank is, that could lead to issues, and I just want to make sure you're going to be including that information in with the aerial photos.
Well, we're still developing, you know, the content that's going to be in that. Kind of what I'm envisioning is a separate kind of cover letter that would accompany it, with that would kind of lay out the basics of what a step collection system is. Again, I think a lot of property owners, you know, at this point are unfamiliar with it. So, you know, the amount of I'm not sure what level of detail yet we're going to go into. There are, of course, people that are interested can dig deeper in certain project reports, but it's going to be a I'm going to have to decide how much level of detail we put in the letter without making it too long.
My concern was if you're going to be using this as primary design and the person goes, oh, well, I'd like it here, mm-hmm. but then they're not realizing that their electrical box is way on the other side of their house other issues like that. Just that way, make that mark, they know what's going to be required if they put it in that location.
Right. I see what you mean. So, yes, that's right, and I think I do plan on including that type of information. I was thinking also in terms of maybe including some information on the difference, you know, some of the potential differences that we identified in the fine screening report between if you put a step tank where your existing tank is,
exactly.
in which case then that would need to be removed and disposed of, versus putting a step tank next, you know, in another location,
and then
being able to have both tanks kind of in place, and then you just change the hookup, and so there's trade-offs there.
Exactly.
So some of that information, and then electrical, of course, would be important.
Okay. And then will the results from the survey differentiate between which groups voted for what? As in prohibition zone homeowners, prohibition zone residents,
Yes.
Okay.
On the community advisory survey, which would go out to the entire community, property owners, residents, business owners, people outside of the prohibition zone, yes, there would be definitely a question to identify what component of the community that you were from.
And then in the timeline that you're running out, with AB 2701, the county still has to accept the project. And where in that timeline do you think that might take place?
I am not sure.
Okay.
That's the discretion of the board. You know, the board has already committed $6 million to the project.
Yeah.
And just the timing of when they adopt that due diligence resolution is
up to them.
At their leisure.
Okay. And then the last question was, when will the assessments start to begin? In other words, when do we start paying for it?
Good question. And for reference, there's a much more detailed discussion of that at the last board meeting, May 6th, if anyone wants to get more into the details. But we are anticipating selling bonds sometime around early 2009 is what we're looking at. And then so the initial assessments on the property tax bills would likely be December 2009, and the bonds that would be sold in this next year would be for the preliminary project efforts and design. So it'd be it wouldn't be for the full amount. You wouldn't be seeing property tax. You know, you wouldn't be seeing assessments on your property tax bills that reflected your full, you know, say $24,900 assessment. They'd be reflecting a smaller amount. And then as the project went through construction and more bonds were sold, that would ramp up to approximately $150 a month at the completion of construction for the assessments.
And then my understanding is But the board has to accept the project before they can start charging us, according
yes.
to what you said.
Okay. The board would have to, I believe the board would have to adopt a due diligence resolution before they can, well, I know they, according to AB 2701, they have to adopt the resolution before they can begin collecting assessments. And I would believe they'd probably have to do that before they can sell bonds also.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any other?
Bill, I had just a couple. One of them, this is just a personal preference, John. On the peer review group, I wonder if you could ask them to have a larger environmental presence than the last round review, because I would welcome seeing some comments in that territory. And then going up with some of the questions that Rob was raising about the other factors on the step tank location, there's also an issue on timing related to whether or not the tank would be placed into an existing leach field area, which has to do with when you could basically start hooking things up to the system. So that was a question. And then still another one, I'm glad I get to give turn these things over to staff to handle. Still another question is the business about being traffic rated, because I certainly would wish to have a step tank buried driveway rather than the garden area, but if that's going to cost me an extra zillion dollars personally, then I might balk at that. So I saw that as still another issue.
Very good. I think the timing on the installations, you know, whatever type of collection system is implemented, you know, that critical window when property owners are switching over from their existing septic tanks to either a step tank or to a sewer lateral for a gravity system is going to be, you know, disruptive to their home, and that's definitely part of the project that needs to be considered.
I wasn't referring to that. The situation goes this way, that ideally you would have a step tank put in place and you'd be able to switch from one system to the other. However, if the step tank is going to be put into a leach field area, you cannot continue to operate the septic
right.
tank.
Right. So that would be similar to if you were putting a new tank in where your existing tank was, because
yes,
it would all have to take place in a, you know, within a short period of time, within a, you know, a day or a few, and you just would have to be.
But
you
it
know,
has to do with the timing of the overall project, because you could not start to install those other step tanks until the system or the treatment plant had been finished.
Right. That would be consistent with either type of collection system, where, you know, the collection system and the treatment plant would need to be in place before then the homes could start hooking up and actually switching over from, you know, existing septic tanks to a central collection system. So that is part of the project construction, where the main collection system and the treatment plant need to be done, and then is the process of then hooking up, you know, 4,500 connections.
Okay, that's the questions. Then we will now go to our agenda items. Our second agenda item, which is a discussion of the project teams. Oh, yes, thank you very much. Accepting minutes. has everyone had a chance to read the minutes of the last meeting? They were sent to everyone. And if so, any comments or omissions, errors? From the TAC? Seeing none, is there anyone in the general public who saw errors or, this isn't comments on the minutes, these are errors in the minutes or omissions in the minutes. Do I see any? No, then I'll look ask for a motion to accept the minutes from our last month's meeting.
So moved.
So moved. A second? And seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, John Waddell again. You know, essentially this tech memo, like many of the others, revisits an issue that was covered in the fine screening report, actually presents a lot of the same information as it develops it for this tech memo. but it identifies for the EI, in the, you know, the primary purpose of this memo and others are for to provide information for the environmental analysis. And so kind of the new information in here is identifying potential pipeline routes, storage requirements, and essentially that is the new information that's developed. There is kind of an interesting analysis for a level 2 project, whereas in the fine screening report, all the projects were identified as a, you know, level 2A, 2B type identification. And you know, the difference between the 2A and the 2B were not that they were different projects, it was just the range of kind of the expected reuse and disposal elements. So, for example, with level 2, what it essentially is, level 2 would be conservation in the community, use of Brodersen at 400,000 gallons per day, use of spray fields to the extent that they were needed, and then use of agricultural reuse to the extent practicable. So the 2A and 2B bracketed the amount of ag reuse from zero to full capacity. Level 2A was full capacity for agriculture reuse at current cropping patterns, and then 2B was assuming no agriculture reuse was implemented at the time the project was brought online. What 2C that was introduced in this tech memo looks at are what are the capacities for ag reuse if you increase the intensity of the agriculture, change the crops to more crops with a higher water demand, and basically changed what the cropping pattern, the change from what the historic cropping patterns are. So again, not an entirely new disposal option, but just another and for is higher for agricultural reuse, or the capacity is higher for spray fields. Those can be utilized more. And then in the winter, when those capacities are decreased, Brodersen can be utilized more. As long as the average annual use of Brodersen remains around 430 acre feet per year, the approach is that the groundwater basin would then have the seawater intrusion mitigation benefits of Brodersen without the need for harvest wells. And then these reuse scenarios with agricultural reuse, then there's the need for storage, for wet weather storage. And if you'll notice that the more agricultural reuse there is, the higher the need for wet weather storage. Because as you rely on ag reuse, and that has a lower capacity than spray fields, then in the wintertime, you know, your storage requirements are going to go up. So that's component of this project, of this level of disposal is that storage will be needed. So again, it identifies the acreage requirements for storage and the potential footprint there for further evaluation in the EIR. I'll take questions, I guess, to start with. Or do you want to have your discussion?
We'll do our discussion, and okay. Then we'll try to gather any questions as we go along. Let's start our discussion this evening on this one with any comments from the Environmental Committee. Go ahead. You're in any order. any questions or comments?
I had two comments. Both of them, I think, relatively minor. One was on Figure 2, where it talks about potential spray field sites at the Tanini Ranch on Figure 2. That figure outlines some areas that shows would be inappropriate for spray field disposal. But then within the areas that's shown as potentially appropriate, I thought it would be worth noting, I'm not sure what the width should be, but there are some blue line streams that run through the middle of that property, and I'm assuming with the nutrient levels in that spray field disposal that there would need to be some buffers. I'm not sure how wide they would be, but buffers along all the water courses through that area. We wouldn't be applying effluent directly. Really the best, one of the best opportunities for getting groundwater recharge and therefore seawater mitigation, that we wanted to maximize that while still avoiding water surfacing downslope and, of course, keeping the hillside intact. And so we talked about what my memory from before that I didn't see in here was kind of an adaptive management approach where we would start with this rate of, I think, 450 acre feet per year, and then use monitoring wells to assess if, as the various reports have said, it can actually handle more than that. You would apply that for a while. You would test and see downslope. You would increase that potentially if it was determined to be safe for the hillside and you didn't have water surfacing downslope. So that discussion of kind of an adaptive management monitoring approach, and in fact, it could work the other way. You could be applying 450 and your monitoring could be showing you that it was too much. And so I guess that discussion of kind of an adaptive approach to the loading at Broderson seems worth getting back in there.
And if I can just comment on that, because my understanding of that was that it was going to ratchet up to that 448. In other words, they're going to start lower and ratchet it up to the 448 to make sure that the hillside could actually take the 448 before we just started flooding it.
Yeah, that's my recollection too. Everything you said except we're not going to start out maximizing. That's what we were talking about, was slowly ramping up in a carefully monitored condition.
And Maria, you have a comment?
I had a question, and I actually called Mark Hutchinson today just to kind of fill him out for a little bit on it regarding the wetlands that are already within the community and how the disposal of the effluent would affect that as it was part of the previous coastal, one of the conditions of the coastal permit. And I was wondering if, Mark, if you would mind, you did such a great job explaining that to me, if you could just take a couple minutes and let the community know what your response to that was.
Did John turn me on or turn me off?
You're on.
Just to refresh everybody, you'll recall that in the last project, as they were going through the coastal development permit process, there was a question about what would happen to small isolated wetlands around the community, backing up again using the Coastal Commission definition, which is notable changes over a number of years. And then there were only some no definite suggestions as to whether or not, if they saw a change, what they would do about it. Although there was some thinking that treated water could be moved around the community, or harvest wells that were planned could be directed to those areas, those kinds of ideas. Sort of from the perspective of wetland mitigation, we've approached that a little bit differently, especially as we look at areas east of town that are ripe for conservation and restoration, that it might be more efficient if there were wetland impacts to actually create wetlands or restore wetlands adjacent to other existing wetland areas. That generally gives you a better bang for your buck mitigation-wise. But also on the issue of whether or not that's an impact that's likely to occur or not is important. And so we've asked the hydrogeologists to look at that. Preliminary indications are actually that impact is likely not to occur. Especially if Broderson is balanced, ramped up to an appropriate level, you would have effluent at that particular location contributing to the underflow and down to the wetlands. But there's also an understanding that although Los Osos does have sandy soils, it is frankly rather densely developed. And all of those hard surfaces that we talk about in our stormwater program actually do contribute water to the upper aquifer. We know that in extreme cases, it actually floods areas of the community, has to be pumped out. But short of that flooding situation, it does percolate a much higher volume of water rainfall than your average community, simply because of the soils. So to shorten this whole story, it appears that we may be able to document that is a impact that is not likely to occur from the project. That being said, we probably will still have the same monitoring requirement from Coastal Commission, but at this point in time, again, preliminary information,
We may be able to document in the EIR that that is an impact with a very low likelihood of occurrence, and probably was all along. But again, it's just never been evaluated in detail.
Thank you, Mark.
Any other comments or questions from environmental? Yes.
The one additional one was that I think the discussion in the report could benefit by a little bit more clarity on infiltration rates and how they're being handled. That if I read.
Thank you. Is there any, let's just take one comment. Any responses or edifications that the county wants to add to that, or you, Rob? Go ahead, Rob.
Just real quickly on the Blue Line stream question. I think as those are reviewed, I know there are situations in agriculture and in other places where blue lines do cross a property, but they're planted across, and would, I think, want to preserve the ability to apply some water in the summer period for agricultural purposes over those areas, but protect them in the wet season. Just a consideration.
Any responses?
I think our response from the team at this time is that these are excellent points. They'll go into the record, and we'll do our best to address those as the project moves forward.
Very good.
But good questions that we don't have answers for today.
Okay. Let's move on then to the engineering committee, technical committee. You have comments or observations, questions? Anybody like to kick that off? John Fouché?
Just going through the document, page 6, I found it interesting that for the spray fields, the last sentence on page 6, the substantial visual and environmental impacts of planting trees would need to be evaluated as part of the environmental review. Usually we're cutting down trees when you want an environmental review. I found it ironic that we're going to look at it too because we're planting trees. Page 7, about produce in the leach fields. I've got a few comments on this. I've mentioned this before at past meetings about produce in leach field and the protocols used to develop the loading rates and infiltration rates and the application rates. And I would, again, I want to encourage the county to do, it sounds like we're going to do a peer review. I hope they're going to look at this a little closer on how this is calculated. Just a couple of observations, just a couple of reasons why I say that. One is the 30 gallons.
Or Kennedy Jenks.
30 gallons per day per square foot number came from a maximum of 180 gallons per square foot. And according to the EPA protocols for rapid infiltration, which it sounds like that's what they're basing these calculations on, you're supposed to use a maximum of 10 to 15% of that number. And 30 gallons is 16.67%, so it's a little over the maximum. And later on in the document, it talks about secondary treatment going up to Brodison, where all these calculations were used using hydrant water, clean drinking water. And there's definitely going to be a difference in application rate, I think, or the calculations or the capacity of this field if we're using wastewater, secondary treated wastewater versus what was used when they did that pilot project up there and calculated 180 gallons per day per square foot. The last sentence in that third paragraph says that leach field design is closer to 7 gallons per day per square foot at full capacity. I would like to see where that number came from because it's been reduced from 30 down to 7. And I'm just not sure where that number, how it was calculated, and where it came from. One other item on Brodison was the liquefaction potential. There's a low potential. I'd to confirm that low potential was added potential, whether it's just low potential or it's added potential. My memory serves that an added potential for liquefaction, low as it may be, but it was added. I think that's about it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Rob, you had a comment on John's comment before we take more?
Mm-hmm. Just very briefly. One thing I think that John's review of the EPA guidelines, aka the ugly purple book, is a good thing, and I think that those should be compared to some of the numbers here. I know one of the things from those guidelines, when they say 10 to 12%, they mean 10 to 12% of the soil permeability, which can be a somewhat higher number than a tested average over a period of time. But I think this would be a very good thing for the peer review group to look at, and I think those EPA manuals are excellent. They're used all the time. And then I'll take a shot at the how they got to the 7, though I didn't do the calculation. I just see that the original design was at 30, and if you cut the flow in half from 800,000 gallons a day to 400,000, that puts you at 15. And if you add 100% redundancy, double the system, that goes 15 down to 7.5, which they said 7. That's probably where they got it.
There's just one other item that I forgot to mention, too, when they use our rapid infiltration for calculation.
Question for Mark. All of these disposal methods we have are either not dealing with seawater intrusion, for instance, spray fields, or we don't have any control over whether or not we're actually going to ever be able to do them, like agricultural reuse. So as part of the environmental process, are you going to be looking at if all of these methods don't pan out? How are you going to approach that with environmental? Possibly looking at injection wells?
Well, the EIR, the focus of the EIR is to look at the impacts of the project that's proposed. So the bottom line for the EIR is whether or not it mitigates its own impact on seawater intrusion, which is the level one project. And there's never been anything that I'm aware of proposed that would be less than that. The level two is simply saying if you put the facilities in to do level one mitigation, increment necessary to maximize those facilities is fairly minor. And so that's kind of where the project is going. And the EIR would look at the impacts of that project, whether it be a mix of Broaddrison or spray fields, or whether there's some other kind of treatment and disposal system that does that kind of work. These other components that are mentioned in here, sort of under the heading of reuse, whether it's urban reuse or ag exchange or all of those things, are looked at in the EIR as potential future actions. And we need to, in an EIR, to the degree that we can, forecast what those impacts might be. Then remembering also that a goal of the project is to maintain the widest possible range of options for reuse. We also want to make sure that a project doesn't get designed that locks the community into a smaller set of options in the future. So the EIR wouldn't necessarily say what happens if we can't do ag exchange, or if it takes 5 years or 10 years, or what happens if urban reuse doesn't pan out or isn't cost effective or something like that. It's going to say the impacts of Broaddrison and the impacts of a spray field are this and that. And the community and the county and the water purveyors taking those options and molding them into a set of projects that can be implemented. We hope to lay a foundation in the EIR for that, but we wouldn't be doing a full analysis on what the impacts might be.
Thank you. Other comments? John?
I wanted to point out a couple of things. Looking at all of the different disposal options that we have here, there is an associated seawater intrusion mitigation factor. And a lot of these things are, the statement that the project does not require water purveyor participation until level three is really not so true when you kind of look at how these seawater mitigation measures or factors are calculated. For instance, in agricultural exchange, it's assuming that by taking the agricultural water well and using that on the east side the water purveyors will reduce the use of their wells on the deep west side, and that will provide a 0.55 seawater mitigation factor. Now, when you look at the three water purveyors, there's Golden State that has two deep wells on the west side, so they have that capability. S&T, they have one well on the deep west side, so they have that capability. The CSD has the library well, which is a deep well in the middle, and that has a seawater mitigation factor of 0.35. So the fact is these seawater intrusion mitigation factors rely on how the existing wells are operated, which means the water purveyors have to cooperate from day one. And that's also true for conservation. They have to set their rates based off of the amount of water they sell, so they have to anticipate any kind of conservation program that would be implemented. So with that in mind, when I was with Golden State, I did witness a lot of cooperation. And there are activities that are ongoing right now, such as an interconnection plan. There is a nitrate treatment program that they're planning on having. They're moving forward with the ISJ, which is the interlocutory stipulated judgment, which is where the three water purveyors in the county actually sign an agreement to work with one another to form a groundwater management plan. So all of these are very, very positive efforts that are actually critical. The answer that we got a year ago, and it is confirmed today, that the answer is yes. Based off the best information that we have, the future water supplies for Los Osos can rely on the groundwater basin to meet its future water supply needs, provided it has a agricultural exchange and purple pipe program of sufficient size. One of the things, so that kind of leads to the importance of that agricultural exchange program, and one of the things I noticed in the technical memorandum here was they estimated a TDS concentration, a measure of salt content, for the what would come out of the wastewater project. And one of the things I wanted to point out is Spencer Harris was the author for the lower zone recharge study, and he did some rather elegant studies, multiple studies, and one of them, one of the basic simple ones that he did was he noted that in the Los Osos Creek compartment, the average or the median TDS there was 524 milligrams per liter. And he also saw that the lower zone had an average concentration of 364, and the upper zone was quite a bit less, ranging from 180 to about 280 milligrams per liter. And he saw the lower zone as being a blend of the upper zone and the Los Osos Creek compartment. Previous to that, it was believed that the Los Osos Creek compartment was the major source of recharge to the lower zone, and Spencer concluded, and with his other studies, rightfully so, concluded that the major source of recharge to the lower zone is the upper zone as it moves through this clay zone. So the reason why I'm bringing all of this up is if we are using the lower zone and we're shifting to the upper zone, our source water TDS will drop. And as you deliver water to a water distribution system, people use the water, put it in the wastewater system, there's a TDS pickup, usually 150 to 200 milligrams per liter. That means the effluent could actually be in approximately the same quality in terms of TDS as they're drawing from the Los Osos Creek compartment now, and with increasing use of the upper zone with the lower TDS concentrations could actually improve the TDS. So I think that's a huge thing to be able to tell our agricultural community about that. And so in this technical memorandum, it didn't really get what memorandum would suggest, which is suggesting already a minor impact. So I think that is pretty much what I wanted to say.
Some very good research there, John. Thank you. Did anyone want to clarify or respond? Or did you have something, Rob? Or
I just did a quick calc for John Fouché based on the amount of feet per year that I think is applied, which I think is 300 to 400, based on the 7 gallons per day per square foot. So I'll pass that. Just engineer to engineer.
Thank you, Russ. I know you've been waiting patiently. I'll, like John, kind of try to keep my comments short here. I recall that the original transfer of water to Broderson was to be tertiary under the original Tri-W or the central site plan. And here it's listed as secondary. But if you look at Table 7, you'll find, indeed, leach fields, which means Broderson is a secondary level of treatment. Also, urban reuse is tertiary, which would imply that we would be bringing two pipes back, one for secondary treatment, back from, assume it's an out-of-town site. So we'd be bringing two pipes back, one for the secondary treated water and the other for the tertiary treated water, which, of course, doesn't make real good sense. And it's to our advantage to use tertiary water for Broderson because it prolongs the life of the leach field. So I can see how one pipe, tertiary water to Broderson would then improve the life of the leach field. The other point I wanted to make, and I think this point is shared by our committee, but I'll speak for myself in this case. When we originally spoke to Spencer Harris a little over a year ago, and then most recently with Tim Cleath, the balance of the water basin plan depends upon agricultural reuse to the tune of something that would be 460 acre feet per year. Now, that may be possible. It may not. In any event, our committee does feel that it's important we have as many disposal methods as possible so we have flexibility for our future. So with that, I want to return to the Broderson site. And I do not want to suggest for as much as we can, provided we do so safely. If we are able to increase the safe use of Broderson site beyond the 400 or so acre feet, acre feet per year they're talking about now, 450 acre feet now, it's again to our advantage. And one of the problems we have, of course, is with the mounding of water downhill in the harvest wells. Now, that was an important problem a few years ago, but perhaps it could be turned to our advantage now. Because as I learned today, that we could right now put a well in those harvest sites, where those mounding sites are, and produce potable water. Yeah. So the question is, well, what happens if we put in tertiary treated water at Broderson? It takes 7 years for it to find its way down and is diluted by the time it gets to the harvest wells, and then we pump it out and use wellhead treatment or some other process so we can use that again safely, it's to our advantage because we'll have the advantage of recharge and we'll be using our water, and that will reduce our use of spray fields and we'll be less reliant on agricultural reuse. So it's something I think we need to keep on the table. It's something that could be important to us. But again, we could only use that if it turns out we could do so safely. So again, I think it's important we expand or maintain as many options as we have. Injection wells, you keep hearing our committee talking about. This is another form of groundwater reuse.
Thank you, Russ. John, yes.
I have to reply to Rob. we're talking about that loading rate a little bit earlier, where it was... I was saying it's around close to 800 feet. Rob came back with 365. That was because of the redundancy, which cut my figure in half once again. I was based on half of the 30, which was 15 gallons per day per square foot. I would ask for the redundancy. The purpose of that, I'm assuming, is for a wet-dry cycle. But once, if that is the case, once again, EPA guideline says that you should have a 2 to 5 time dry cycle compared to the wet cycle, which means if you only got twice redundancy, you really got wet out there too often. Does that make sense? So anyway, that's the other thing I would ask you to look at.
Yeah, I think that's well put. I think comparing that EPA guideline, is that the total site of the percolation? Careful of how much water you put at Broderson relative to how much you can extract down gradient, is that as your percentage of water that originates from wastewater increases, there are some trigger points through the Department of Health Services, what's Department of Public Health now, some trigger points that could require further treatment that now you're starting to spend dollars on wastewater treatment, which may not be the most cost-effective approach. And Ag Exchange and other programs may then rise to the top once you start to hit those trigger points. I think that that's something that's important to look at.
Very good. Did I see comments from engineering? Then I'll move over to a financial group.
Okay. We kind of put some of our questions together. Karen forwarded several to me, so this is kind of coming from most of us. Okay. We had some of the same questions regarding the leach fields as far as, so thank you for going through that already for us. A couple questions about Broderson. Why is, if the pipes are going to be buried 5 to 6 feet below the surface, why does there need to be fencing around it? There's a lot of trails up through that area, and we were just looking for a little information on that. Then regarding the spray fields, just wanted to make a comment that evapotranspiration basically equals wasted water. And we understand that the county, this is basically our worst case scenario, and that this, if we can't get rid of the water anywhere else and we have to go, this is the way it would go, but we're all working to make sure that that does not happen. We were wondering how far Tonini is from Giacomazzi, and if we have to lose water to the basin, wouldn't it make more sense to send that treated effluent to farms to the east of the basin rather than to Tonini, thereby saving piping and O&M of the Tonini spray fields? Plus, wouldn't that open up the possibility of importing water from the harvest, the wells that are currently being used as ag wells outside the basin? We might be able to work an ag exchange program outside the basin by giving them our water and drawing a purveyors might lose some income. And basically she was wondering why we would care if the purveyors lose income, and Pavo gave a good answer to that. And she was hoping that you would repeat that answer. It was Karen's question.
could I add to that? My impression of the school district installing a new well, they're going to sink some cost into that. Once they put that well in, they're going to use that for until it's busted 30, 40 years from now. By putting that well in, they are eliminating an opportunity for a purple pipe system. Although the fine screening report talks about that not being cost effective, I think having that available for a purple pipe system, if development were to occur in Los Osos for a housing tract per se, and with the new ordinances for retrofitting, there may be a potential for a developer to fund a purple pipe system in exchange for the conservation credits. I think it would be of community-wide benefit for the schools to remain available to a potential future purple pipe project. With that said, though, the water purveyors have an increasing rate block structure for conservation, and that has a negative impact on the school. The school is paying incredibly, almost triple the amount through the CSD's increasing rate block structure as compared to Golden State. And that is the trigger why they're looking into putting in a new well. I would encourage the CSD to reevaluate that because the school districts are tight on funding, and I'd much rather see the money being spent on the students rather than on a utility. And the ultimate idea with conservation is to reduce the demand, and a purple pipe system will do that. So that's my thoughts on that.
John,
if I can add to that, and I think those are good comments, John. For one, on the idea of loss of income to the water purveyors. You know, the CSD is a public agency that their rates are based on their costs, and if their fixed costs stay the same, but they're getting less revenue, extract water, you know, the wells to bring up groundwater, distribute it to the community, including the schools, is in place. For the schools to go spend money on more wells and basically redundant infrastructure is a net cost to the community. The schools are in the community, and it's a net cost to the community. It may save the schools money, but overall, in terms of the whole community, they are spending money for redundant infrastructure, so that, you know, if agreement can be reached between schools and water purveyors on some type of agreeable situation that would avoid that extra expense of installing wells and creating redundant, you know, facilities, then you would avoid that net cost to the community.
Just can I add one more thing?
Yes.
With that said, the schools offer a potential for the purveyors to add strategic well sites to their supply. The CSD was looking at and have installed upper zone wells, and it may be needed to have upper zone wells. Finding a well site is pretty difficult. If the school district is participating in helping this community solve its problem, a well site would be a good thing, with sized for domestic supply in mind for the entire community, as opposed to a smaller scaled system for irrigation supply. So I see a lot of potential benefit here for the school to help participate in solving the community's issues here, remaining available for Purple Pipe System, but knowing the reason why they're even looking at this is because of an increasing rate block structure that has really penalized the school district to the point where economically it makes sense for them to eliminate this Purple Pipe opportunity for us in the future. So I would encourage the CSD to revisit that.
Thank you, John. Did we finish your comments, Rob?
I had one more.
Okay.
Regarding Broaderson and urban reuse, we were wondering if it was absolutely necessary. Basically, if you look at doing a full ag use with intensive crops and then potentially do...
Is there any... Oh, yes, Rob.
Just real briefly, on the Tanini property, and I agree that we want to look for options that are in basin that maximize our use of the water, minimize wasting. There are several wells out in Tanini that we've talked about over time. Some of them, you know, decent producers, similar to the upper aquifer wells that the CSD is producing, 100 gallons a minute, 200 gallons a minute, not tiny wells that are irrigating current row crops. So that is one candidate to do exactly what you're saying if we end up forced out there for a portion of the effluent.
Thank you. Is there any comments that staff would make before turning to public comment then?
Well, just in response to Rob Scheib's kind of list of comments, I think we're going to have to go back and look at some of these. I know the very first one, why the fencing on Broaderson, and actually I had kind of flagged that earlier also. I'm not sure why. And Mark agrees. I don't know why it would be a requirement for fencing on Broaderson. As far as, you know, additional ag reuse or ag exchange areas in areas outside of the basin, you know, east of town, you know, we've been focusing our efforts on ag exchange and reuse within the basin and maintaining, you know, with the you know, minimizing piping and other infrastructure. So, and we haven't looked at, you know, the basically the feasibility and the quality and quantity of water that's available out there. You know, I do know that one thing we've identified in our reports is the most likely, well, not the most likely, but a likely scenario for Ag Exchange would require the a public agency to buy the property that the water was would be exchanged from, and then have to lease it back for farmers. And so then you're getting into appropriating water from outside the basin, and bringing it into Los Osos, and then the surrounding, and then you'd have water rights. You may have water rights issues with surrounding property owners. So importing water from out of the basin does come with a number of issues that need to be addressed.
Thank you, John. Dan?
Yeah, I had a question for Rob following up this idea of agricultural exchange where we're actually pumping water, taking water from well.
That they go after, in South County it's happened several times. Some of them are subject of current LAFCO proceedings. But it is complicated. It's done, but it's complicated.
And isn't that sort of what's underlying part of the endless Napomo water?
Yeah,
legal
and the five cities
well?
Area too. Yeah.
Okay. Well, then, with that, we will begin our public comment. If I can have the slips. We are running a little late this evening, so I would request that. Speakers, if your point has been brought up by a previous speaker, if you just acknowledge that, but if you don't have to use all of your 3 minutes, please give us that back so we can move along. Our first speaker is Al Barrow, followed by Gail McPherson.
Good evening. This is Al Barrow. I thought your discussion was pretty good. Sounds like people have been reading and studying. I like John Brady's comments a lot. I didn't think he wasted any words. He talked about nitrogen treatment. Well, what he was really talking about was the ion exchange technology, I believe. And I'd like to have him enlarge on the cost a little bit. We had a discussion at Starbucks, just casually. He made a number of $150 an acre foot as cost. So if water can be achieved in the upper aquifer, which has a lot of nitrogen in it, and may be made potable, that is good news, isn't it? So that would be one thing. There's 250,000 acre feet in our upper aquifer down to the level 200 below grade. 250,000 acre feet, if you can harvest it, it's enough for 80 to 100 years. So I think that's interesting. One of the factors that I think is really important to think about is how does our disposal reuse affect our treatment requirements? And what I'm saying here is that if you do not have to remove nutrients like nitrogen and ammonia to a high degree, then you reduce your carbon footprint for energy because it takes oxygen, and oxygen it requires energy. So I think there's a balance there, and this cannot be shadowed a little bit too. I wanted to say a little bit about Brodersen, and Brodersen does have, there was a study done by Fugro, it's 500 pages, on the liquefaction conditions at Brodersen, and he said really clearly that the liquefaction condition would require that whatever kind of treatment you'd have, you would have to have emergency stored parts for the destroyed infrastructure. So they do anticipate if there was an earthquake that would be a destruction of the infrastructure, which would have to be repaired. So having the mound system, the full-on mound, could create the liquefaction more intense, and that's you did discuss it a little bit. But purple pipe is an interesting thing. If you have nitrogen in areas around the basin in the upper aquifer that are high nitrogen, why not harvest them and use them for the purple pipe system? Thank you
very much, Al. Gail McPherson, and Gail submitted written documents to me, which will be given to the staff and put in the meeting. And following Gail McPherson is Keith Weimer.
Pardon me. Oh, good evening. Some of my questions that I have submitted in statements in the document have been answered, at least in part, and one was the third-party review or the NWRI review. Broderson, when it was put to the old project at Tri-W, was kind of a convoluted process. It was, if you really look at all the data and information, it looks like it was kind of reversed engineered to how much water do we have and can it fit there. And so I'd like to see all of the assumptions going into that, including the EPA reports that were used, which I believe the rapid infiltration rate is not the right one to be using, and it isn't accurate. But it's very convoluted, and it's very difficult to sort through and sift through everything to get where you need to be on the application rates. Some people may remember that last Friday that we went to the Water Board about the basin plan. The basin plan changes were about subsurface disposal, and subsurface disposal does not, in AB 885, doesn't distinguish between Broderson and your own leach field. It's either a community system or it's your own on-site system. And so if you have 1 inch per foot, one minute per inch per foot, I'm sorry, if your infiltration rate is fast, it's not part of the basin plan. It's prohibited under AB 885. So you need to go back and look at that site in proximity to Broderson as cost effective. So I think you've got to kind of toss out all of the old assumptions about Broderson and really start over and say, do we really want Broderson? Is it the right spot? Is it worth it? I know you want flexibility and all that, but the loading rates, there's a lot of uncertainty. John asked some of the questions. John Brady answered some questions. DHS kicks in with your direct reuse. We've got regulations that you haven't considered. Ag exchange is a really good idea because it can be brought to 100%. Many, many communities have done that for years and years and years. There's lots of information, including winter storage in a reservoir rather than trying to stuff it in the ground. And I have a lot of other comments and questions. Let me see if I can just get back to them. I'm almost done here.
Time is up.
I guess I am done.
We do have your report, we'll put it in.
I'll augment that based on some of the comments tonight.
Thank you very much. Keith Weimer, followed by Frank Acilio.
Keith Weimer, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was one of the ones that signed and support the EIR document that went to the supervisors this last Tuesday. It were recommendations for a sustainable project. And I just want to touch on a few of the criteria and guidelines for sustainability that was covered in that document. One, it's a project that takes a precautionary approach to prevention of environmental damage. Two, it applies an integrated whole systems long-term approach which seeks multiple solutions. Three, it seeks energy-efficient solutions using renewable, clean energy sources, solar and wind. Four, it strives for a system that puts no toxins in the environment, maximizes reclamation and beneficial reuse, and has zero restorative net effects on carbon production and so on. And then as far as the APA Association guidelines for wastewater, one of them was it reduces dependence on chemicals, treatment facilities that remove or destroy pathogens without creating chemically contaminated byproducts like chlorine byproducts. And they meet human needs fairly and efficiently by cleaning, conserving. Excuse me, sir. Yeah. Excuse me. Would you start the time over again, please?
No, we'll continue because you aren't on the subject. So go ahead.
These are the criteria that apply to the TM that I'm going to talk about.
We're talking about the effluent return, not the general
Sir,
project.
I'm going to apply these criteria to Broderson 100 acre feet of water that will not be going into leach fields when septics are taken off. Without adequate recharge of the upper aquifer, as John mentioned, you don't have adequate recharge of the lower aquifer, and you don't have the same subsurface flows as sensitive wetlands. It does not multiply solutions. Rather, it locks us into a certain choice, limited recharge, limited seawater mitigation, poor community acceptance, no conservation or reuse element to it. It's not energy efficient. It doesn't lend itself to clean energy use. It does not avoid chemicals in a treatment process and will probably take more chemicals because it will take some storage and it will take chlorine to disinfect it, and that chlorine will then be forced in even to the lower aquifer. In other words, emerging contaminants will not be avoided. Broderson sinks money where it's not likely to be recovered, and it's not worth the gamble. On the other hand, a reuse disposal method that maximizes options and creates multiple solutions is a purple pipe system to individual homes, and that option should be used to completely replace the Brodersen option.
Could you it please recharges, conclude?
It conserves water, it can, we can use about half, and all the surplus could go out of town to ag reuse and so on.
Thank you very much. Frank Acilio, followed by Thomas Rohr.
Evening, Frank Acilio. I have some questions. Because I'm a little confused about the system here, it seems to be directed towards a centralized system. So I don't know if there's going to be, is that the system planned? Is that a centralized system collecting all this water to be used up to Brodersen or somewhere else? Or are we going to have a decentralized system to treat wastewater system that would be a totally different package than what's presented here that in this technical manual? So I'm not I'm a little confused on that issue. Also, if there is a centralized system, water is collected, who does the water belong to that's collected? Do the people in the prohibition zone own that water when you talk about water rights? You talk I liked it, what Bob said about the look further in the injection wells. Orange County uses injection wells. They're treating their water, reusing set water to see if that's viable, maybe upfront higher cost, but in the long run, maybe the way to go, a less cost overall and a need to import water or try to, or somehow, ability to recharge the system, to keep the system in a cycle. I think that would be best for all of us. Also, what legislation is going to be coming down? You know, will there be legislation come down say you can't use spray fields anymore? I can see that as time goes on, and we become the state is short on water statewide, and you'll see some legislator come and say, no, your community has to reuse that water. No spraying on spray fields, you know, using that water out there. So you have to look at not only current legislation, but potential legislation coming down the pipe. And I would think John would know some of that. The other thing is the, let's see, that's it then for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thomas Rohr, followed by Chuck Cesena.
I'm Tom Rohr. The critical issues of treated wastewater use and disposal. Page 7. First, testing at the Brodersen site resulted in a water infiltration rate of 180 gallons per day per square foot through the wetted surface of the trench during the prototype testing. This must have been going through the sidewalls as well. Secondly, the Fugro West 204 study recommended using a maximum application rate of 30 gallons of treated wastewater per day per square foot, whereas the previous sewer project in 2001 determined a recommended rate of only 7 gallons of treated wastewater per day per square foot. Third, the Brodersen site percolation rate data in 2003 indicated all sites had percolation rates greater than 1 minute to percolate 1 inch of treated wastewater. Table 2 and Figure 1 of March 207 draft law AB 885 says that under these conditions, a maximum application rate of 1.2 gallons of treated wastewater per day per square foot. What is the correct value? 180 or 30 or 7 or 1.2? As a soil scientist, I know that a sustained water application rate of the lowest rate of 1.2 gallons of wastewater per day per square foot cannot be sustained in Los Osos dune sands. These sands are permeated with thousands of very horizontal pencil-thin clay lamellae. These lamellae cause the water to move faster horizontally than vertically. The bottom line is the Brodersen site is dead in the water for high-rate wastewater application, as is every other possible site anywhere on the Los Osos dune sheet. It's an absolute fatal flaw in the proposed sewer. I made this known back in 1992 on the nitrate TAC. This result must be dealt with appropriately in the environmental impact report. Four, the final proposed sewer project must have an effective, environmentally sound, and unified collection, treatment, and wastewater application system. It must not be segmented with the idea of solving the wastewater application problem sometime in the future. This fatal flaw will cause each resident of the Los Osos to have to pay over $1 million to fix this problem created by the inability of these studies to provide a single unified value. I will hand out my comments.
Thank you very much. Please. Chuck Cesena, followed by Mary Falwell.
Good evening, TAC. My name is Chuck Cesena, and I want to start by thanking some of you for the comments you made, Mr. Brady. The purveyors are certainly on board. We are taking actions. That's been happening, and part of that is a tiered rate structure, and perhaps with the school district that has backfired, and that is something that maybe should be looked into a little bit further. I want to thank Mr. Fouché for his questions about Broderson and Mr. Berman for his comments about the fact that this was supposed to be a managed approach all along, not just assumptions made about rates that could be used, because every assumption that's been made seems a little gray and fuzzy so far. And I think this is a critical, critical piece. Others have said it better already, but the whole Broderson issue, is that why Montgomery Watson Harzin ever stamped the Tri-W project report? Even in 2006, they would not answer these same questions about the application rates at that leach field. So there's some serious problems with Broderson if it turns out that that site is closer to the picture Dr. Ruhr paints. It's not going to be usable at all, and ag reuse is going to be the key to the problem here. And in that regard, and this is more for the project team, it seems like the effluent disposal and reuse part of the equation isn't going to be part of the design build process. And I want to know why you segregate out a key part of this whole project and make it a separate process. Why preclude someone who comes in with a good overall project, but they enforce them to use one of your leach field schemes that may or may not even be a good idea? I would just say, boy, let everything be a part of that RFP process. Let's see, did I miss anything?
Ellen Pavo can be found on the county's website now, as well as on Surfrider's website, which is slosurfrider.org. I'm really enjoying the public comment. I really appreciate Frank Asilio's points that the focus feels like it's on centralized, and you haven't really talked about the benefits of decentralized. I can't remember. I know Pavo was at Pio Lombardo's presentation, and I know Ripley Orenko has also talked about Purple Pipe. This goes into what Chuck is saying about if there's a whole system proposed, why not look at the whole system? I know Pio's presentation and Ripley's, they're coming in the same type of budget of what, $127 million. And the Purple are under, but within the budget that you guys have set aside or through the assessment stuff. So hearing that Purple Pipe, I think it was John Brady saying that in the EIR scoping, the Purple Pipe is seen as not cost effective, which seems like a poor evaluation of Purple Pipe. And I hope you guys will continue to evaluate Purple Pipe more fully, especially because if it can be utilized for landscape reuse, you can benefit the aquifer, seawater intrusion, and hopefully reduce our water bills, which we all know are, or at least for Golden State, we're at a 40% increase. Also, real concern about the Broderson as a topic. It's so risky to the bay, and Fish and Game, I don't have their quote right now, but Fish and Game has said that any disposal into the newly designated SMR will be fined, even tertiary level water, because it'll affect the salinity of the bay. So that just feels not only risky to homes as a location, but also to the bay. And I guess that's it. I'm a bit saddened that Purple Pipe and decentralized are not more of your conversation tonight. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Lindy Owen, followed by Lawson Schaller.
Good evening, Lindy Owen. I will have to agree with the last two speakers. Breaking this into areas is like going to buy a house and looking at the roof on six different houses and then coming looking at the structure, the foundation on six different houses, and then trying to pick which one you'd want to buy. This is the worst way to be doing it, but anyway, the wetlands destruction, what is that going to cost? It's probably the least effective way of re-injecting to the lower aquifer, and it also shows a huge possibility of liquefaction. And if you don't remember La Conchita, you might go back and check it out. It became an issue of putting a lot of water in one spot. Right now, our septic tanks are spread out over a huge area, and small amounts are evenly distributed. When you take and you put that much water in one tiny spot, liquefaction will occur. It's been studied. We have clay lenses. The water will end up going that way. And there is no amount that you can, you know, guesstimate that might cost if we had all those, that whole hill sliding. I also, using 440 acre feet to not exceed the current leach, okay, that was, I already said that. Doesn't it need to be tertiary treated for disposal? So I don't know why you're talking about secondary treatment. How can you state that water conservation measures belong to are a responsibility of the water purveyors and then show concern for saltwater intrusion? I don't understand how you can do both. Dr. Westman said that Broderson had the highest hope to recharge the lower aquifer. It's a lot cheaper to go ahead and do what Golden State is beginning to do, which is to use the upper aquifer. It is currently wasting its way out into the ocean. Why are we not using that instead of spending a ton of money trying to see how we could push water down into that area? Just stop using those lower aquifer wells everywhere and start using from the upper aquifer and blending as much as we can. That is a cheap and effective way to do something about our saltwater intrusion, not, you know, paying tons of money to push it up a hill and then risk everything. The school disposal right now, the CSD had an opportunity to, with their recovering water down at their 6th Street place, that water could have been sent over to the school district and put onto the Baywood Elementary, but nobody wants to look at
much,
that.
Thank you very much, Lindy. Lawson Schaller, followed by Richard Marketson.
Good evening, Lawson Schaller. First, I want to thank all the TAC members for the time you're putting in. I know it's a sacrifice and a compromise you're making with family and friends. Some specific questions. First, a comment. Dr. Westman mentioned that we need as many possible disposable alternatives as possible for flexibility, and I strongly agree with that. We need as many options as we can get. Now, specific questions, reuse or disposal. Page 9, Broderson Leach Field, they used the term ripping. I assume that's repair, reconstruction, or cleaning. But if you could just give me a brief definition and what an approximate cost might be. Appreciate John Fouché's comments about the low potential for liquefaction. I would like to know if we can somehow quantify that potential. If nothing else, put it within some broad brackets or parameters. Appreciate Dan Berman's comments about including the adopted managed approach and Rob's follow-up comments and everyone else's about a very careful ramp-up. I was going to ask, is that still a controversial subject? Well, I think I got my answer through some of the previous speakers. So, talked about wells downgrade from Broderson. I'm just curious where those might be roughly. This is not a question, just a comment. I found it very encouraging on page 14, Monterey County. 12 billion gallons a year, I guess. That seems like an awful lot of water they're recycling. I assume that's accurate, but that was quite a significant number. Page 17, soil beneath wetlands. The document states would eventually become clogged and impede percolation. Is that would or should that be a could? I mean, is it absolutely definite that these do? Is it well known and accepted among scientists that they become clogged? And if they do, do they need some sort of rebuilding or ripping? I assume not. It seems that once you construct the wetlands, and this is something I wanted to confirm, is that the once it's a wetland, that we'd lose that water. It has to, I guess, in perpetuity, continue to flow to the wetland in order to keep it a wetland. That's the only downside I can see to wetlands. And just another comment. real interesting piece. I don't know how applicable it is. I'll wrap up, Mr. Chairman. If you Google Clayton County NPR, which stands for National Public Radio, there's an interesting less than 4 minute piece on ponds. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Richard Markison, followed by our last speaker, Alon Perlman.
Richard Margetson, first comment deals with the comments about the middle school and the effects that it would have on the rates for the rest of the customers in the CSD district. Doesn't that also apply to water conservation?
Yeah.
Water conservation is going to cause the rates to go up too. People are going to have to get used to the idea that they may have to pay the same amount that acre feet. 3.3 million gallons per day for the 3 months per year. Well, in the urban, the Los Osos Urban Water Management Plan that Rob's firm did, this is the sentence that I keep coming back to that I tried to prove to you at the last meeting. The estimated population at build out for the community is 19,653. That's only 60 off of the Estero Area Plan estimate. And build out population for within the project area of 17,268. At some point, that number is going to have to get corrected before we get to the appeal process. And I'm also concerned about the statement in here about the 3 months per year. The fine screening report in developing the average dry weather or wet weather, average daily wet weather flow used 4 months, used January, February, March, and April in the fine screening report. In the technical memo, they revised it and added 2007 figures. But in this technical memo, if you go to page or diagram 8, the 3 months they're talking about are December, January, and February. These continued inconsistencies have got to be corrected at some point before we get much further. And if these are corrected now, maybe you can truly establish what your disposal rate's going to be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our last speaker is Alon Perlman.
Alon Perlman, Prohibition Zone. Had I known all these people were going to speak, I would have held back my card, but here we go again. To summarize, and this is available on a page within this report that describes the Broderson site. I'm going to be leafing to look for it, but the bottom line is wise men don't build their leach field on a slope, or rather beneath a slope. The area above Broderson is actually a moisture, is, let's put it this way, you have the one of the highest elevations on a coast, on this current coast. The prevailing winds carry far, our ability to predict that. So I don't know how, I would not encourage everybody to believe that Broderson can't be used entirely, but any, it doesn't sound from the consensus that it's going to be much more than a 7% solution. It's definitely not going to be able to manage the application rates originally identified. Some of the previous speakers described laterality. Mr. Milanes is here today. He recently bored a well into the ground. In 200 feet, he encountered about 20 different layers, pervious and impervious. So the areas to the sides of Broderson are actually lived on, are not in the prohibition zone, and will have an unknown future in terms of their nitrates handling. Although the basin plan has changed, that will not necessarily affect existing structures, but there is a lateral potential for infiltration of nitrates from the sides. As you increase the load, you may be actually carrying nitrates that were never traveling before along with your supernatant itself. So the actual total transport of nitrates down through the layers may actually be increased. So it can't handle as much water, and I do believe that nitrate, I just invented a word, basin-wide nitrate loading profile. If you change it, you may end up with more nitrates than ever before.
Thank you, Alan. That was the end of our speakers. I'm going to ask if any responses in the interest of time, quick answers to questions, but keep them short, please. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, there's too many questions and excellent time of public comment, and I trust the county's taken note of those questions. Just very briefly, I think the NWRI peer review presents a very unique opportunity to resolve some of these issues, appropriate application rate, appropriate governing standard for this, appropriate treatment level for Broaddrison. All those things, I think, will be a very important subject of the upcoming peer review.
Thank you. And that's it on comments. Mark, you're reaching for a... Go ahead.
I did want to make...
Okay, with that, I want to move to our next item on our agenda, which is partially mixed facultative ponds. And we'll begin with a short introduction from the staff on what this one is all about.
Second. Okay, Mr. Chair, it's John Waddell again. The basic approach to the facultative ponds tech memo is to provide a higher level of detail on facultative ponds than was in the fine screening report. As you may recall, in the fine screening report, as a partially mixed facultative ponds were lumped into kind of one general category, and you know, costs, energy use, footprint were all generalized for facultative ponds. So in moving forward, both with technology selection, but also with environmental impact analysis, the need for a follow-up tech memo to get into more detail on facultative ponds and identify the differences in some of the technologies, and some of these are proprietary technologies. And so I'm just going to kind of, to keep this short, direct you to page 11 and tables 2 and 3, where there's kind of the summary of potential footprints. And by example, in the fine screening report, facultative ponds were generally given a footprint of 20 acres. As you'll see on here, the Nelson ponds are about in that range, but there are other AIPS and the DPMC ponds, which are lower footprint requirements and have a corresponding higher energy requirement. The tech memo goes through that discussion of the that inverse relationship of land requirement versus energy requirement. And also on that page, then there's a breakdown of pond construction costs by technology. So, you know, the general idea of this is to look at ponds in a higher level of detail for both for the environmental analysis and for technology selection. I did note just to look back through the tech memo and follow that math that's the I guess you could call it I wouldn't call it a math error, but I would call it a typo.
Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to bring it to the TAC for comments and questions. And we'll start, how about we start with the financial group this time? Are you folks ready? Rob? No, okay. How about engineering? You got any comments from our engineering group? John? Oh, Russ, okay.
I'll just make two comments. One is, I thought the report understated a very important point with respect to the facultative pond, and that was the extremely low resultant biosolids coming out of that. Now, perhaps this will be covered when we do talk about biosolid disposal, but I thought it should have been included here because I know I was surprised when I first learned about this, and I know our committee thinks it's a very important issue. So the fact that there's practically no biosolids is a big plus. Same time, there's also a control issue here where it appears that there's not a tight control over the nitrogen level that comes out of the system. And also, it seems to be some variation due to temperature and other environmental issues. And, of course, there will be secondary, tertiary treatment required, but I don't know how this works, but it may be difficult to keep up with the output, the variable output from the pond system when you run it through your polishing treatment, and I guess care would have to be exercised there.
Thank you. John? Go
ahead. Just to add to Russ's comments, one of the things I think that needs to be recognized also, and it is stated in the report, that the amount of manpower or person years is only 1.5 people per year to run a ponding system, which is, I believe, lower than just about any other system. Something else to keep in mind with ponds, they are below ground. They're holes in the ground. It's not a structure above the ground like other systems would be. And I will reemphasize what
process, the space and provisions, you know, requirements and costs for those. I know when we went to the Cypress Ridge plant up there in Napomo and saw this ponding system there, they had something called a PAL filter, which was a microfiltration system. And that doesn't remove nitrates, so I'm curious to know, learn a lot more about the denitrification treatment, presented in a technical memorandum. Whether they're using nitrates or an enhanced, basically a biological type treatment system to do the, nitrification, denitrification process. So that's what I had to say.
That was Monarch Dunes, not Cypress Ridge. Well, yeah. Monarch Dunes, not Cypress Ridge, was the plant we visited. Are you ready? Okay. And we'll take it over to financial then.
Okay. Basically, we just kind of did some comparisons of the DPCM, or MC, the AIPS, and the ADS, and it looks like the AIPS has a small footprint, and with median construction costs, low O&M and energy requirements, and also had the lowest BOD and TSS results. We had a comment on energy, and we think that the O&M costs need to project the rising costs of energy because energy costs are increasing exponentially. And then the project costs, I need to reevaluate overall project cost comparison using this info for capital versus O&M costs in terms of seeing how they weigh out over 20, 30 years. We also had a question on the ADS cost. Does that include lining? And if so, what type?
How about environmental? Do we have some comments from environmental?
The only comment I believe that we had was in regards to no specific sites mentioned, and so what followed in that conversation was that it would probably be a mix and match of some of the identified sites. Did I get that? Our concern?
Yeah, well, and again, Marsh is sort of consistent with the, and this came out in the fine screening and the pro-con analysis, is really a real advantages of this. To John Brady's comment about the nitrification and denitrification, I don't remember from the fine screening, but how that, the energy requirements for doing that, when you factor that back in, how much does that affect the sort of energy benefit of this kind of a treatment approach is another question.
Can I Just on the follow-up of the ponds, this just talks about the ponds and possibly not all the other facilities that would be required in conjunction with them?
In terms of the acreage.
And part of the discussion would also then follow around the mitigation requirements versus number of acreage required needed for treatment and storage and all the other business facilities.
Why don't we go to Russ first? Okay.
Just a quick response to something that Rob said. I do not disagree with electricity prices going up in the future. It's the exponential factor that I disagree with, and that's based on a small consulting activity I had in the last 6 months where a school district...
I'll withdraw the term.
Well, all right, I'll simply say this. Power projections by Southern California Edison Company, PGE, and the Department of State of Energy did not use the word exponential.
Thank you for the clarification, Russell. Rob?
Rob's fast. Just a couple comments. One is relating to a couple issues regarding denitrification. Just to clarify, for the purposes of this memo, two steps are necessary for nitrogen removal, well, actually more than two, but simplifying it to two. The first is the conversion of ammonia and organic forms to nitrate. That is addressed in some of the construction costs here. The denitrification is left to the fine screening report, and that is slow sand or sand filtration with methanol addition is what was contemplated in the fine screening report, which doesn't have a lot of energy required. It has a methanol requirement. There is some language in the disposal TM that talks about wetlands a little bit and testing those out for denitrification capabilities. But for the purpose of admin building, tertiary filtration building, those would be very small in relation to the overall pond, similar to the Monarch Dunes facility where you have very small admin component compared to the overall size of the ponds. And I think that's all.
Bob?
I have a question, I guess, probably for Rob. Many of these pond systems, the data, it doesn't meet the 7 milligrams per liter requirement. Now, Nelson says they will give a limited guarantee, and it talks about ammonia less than 7 milligrams per liter for 5 years. What is a limited guarantee, and what happens after 5 years?
Go ahead, Rob.
That's a loaded question. I don't think I have an answer to all those questions. I think it's the consultant's responsibility. In this case, it would be Carollo to achieve a level of comfort. I mean, I think the ability of a manufacturer to provide a treatment guarantee is unique, and that's one thing that ADS does. And it's a pretty straightforward, broad guarantee. Whether they would step up and pay millions of dollars, I don't know. But I can tell you from a nitrification standpoint, well, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, because I know you know those terms very well in your backyard, but nitrification data with ADS is pretty strong. I mean, they have some very high levels of ammonia. They're achieving very low levels of effluent ammonia, and they're nitrifying effectively. So I think Carollo and our firm certainly feels comfortable that can be achieved with these systems. The ability to denitrify, because that's never been required for many of these surface dischargers back in the Midwest and so forth. They just don't have to do it. Carollo and our firm and others would rely upon extensive data for the ability of sand filters to denitrify a nitrified effluent. You know, you can have even the Nitrex system that you hear in the decentralized, that's really just a, you know, carbon impregnated media similar to what you'd get by adding methanol to sand. I didn't mean to oversimplify that, but those technologies, we have lots of data that say
weather storage.
I don't think it would have an appreciable effect. I mean, you'd have a little more rain catchment in your treatment area, but in terms of the amount of water coming down at a million gallons a day, it'd be very small in relation to the
whole
thing.
I was just wondering if it would reduce it.
No, I mean, you could build some more freeboard into the ponds and do that, but the scale of the amount of water coming in wouldn't make that a major factor.
Thank you. Is there any responses or that the project team has?
Well, yes, I'll kind of follow up with Rob. And Rob, thank you for the good explanations on some of those. On the denitrification facilities that we, you know, Rob was just talking about, in the fine screening report, it does present the cost estimates for denitrification. It also presents, it breaks it down into percent of flow. So if you were looking at only denitrifying part of the effluent for, you know, return to the community, and part of the effluent was, say, going to spray fields, it provides kind of a breakdown of some different levels of denitrification. And kind of a question on site, and how would these facilities fit on a site? If there is the potential, if you have contiguous sites, say, in the Giacomozzi area, that the potential more than one site. So there's not, you don't, there's, just because if an individual site does not have enough capacity, there's, but there is an adjacent site that you may be able to also add. So, you know, siting of these ponds would be, you know, potentially feasible on, you know, many of the sites that are being considered.
When do we expect to see those the costs of that reflected somewhere?
The costs
of the purchasing of multiple properties.
Well, I think that in the fine screening report, I think the price is kind of a price per acre, and that would still be consistent.
The comments? And with that, we'll open this up to public comment. Do I have any speaker slips? Again, in the interest of timing, if you could keep it to no more than 2 or 3 minutes, but if you don't need all your time, please cede it to the next speaker. And our first speaker is going to be Gail McPherson, followed by Al Barrow.
Good evening. I wanted to note, starting out with the ponds, I didn't get a chance to go through the whole entire document, but the Nelson ponds were, of course, the project that was the basis for the recall, and the one that was put forward worse and worse and worse as the years go on. And so that, and also the septage receiving that a pond can take with the stability of a pond. I also wanted to note that the flow train, a lot of people have already said the things that I was going to say, which is great. The staffing, the complexity or the lack of complexity with the pond, the low profile, there's some huge advantages. I'd like to have that checked out. Also, the schematic, you know, Nelson put together in their proposal a really nice schematic that showed where you can kind of set up your flows for a kind of a recipe for where you're going to reuse that water. And so you had that flexibility to treat to just a certain level. And the energy for getting to nitrification is where most of your energy is going to go, denitrification. If the ponds could be set up and operated and do denitrify, you wouldn't have to use that filter. But if you have it, we put it in there as an extra piece because we wanted to make sure we had that reliability and guarantee. And then also Nelson is in a cold area, so a lot of their data for their guarantee and everything had to do with the fact that in a warm area it's pretty easy to nitrify. In fact, it's almost difficult not to nitrify. So the low energy and the other benefits that I mentioned, I think, make the Nelson Pond a really important one to look closely at. And with that, I'll end my comments. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Al Barrow, followed by Frank Osilio.
Thank you. In 2000, in August, when the CSD decided to drop their pond system because it had such a large footprint, I went to John Hindy Air Diffusion Systems in Iowa. That's one of the other companies, in addition to Martin Hildebrand of the Nelson Company in Canada. He came out twice, and he made presentations here in the room. I do have that that design that Gail talked about. It's on CASE website, case-environmental.org. Shows the five pond, how they work. He just added, as Gail said, the uplift flow sand filter to polish to below 7 milligrams per liter if it was needed. And as she said also, why treat all that to that level if you can utilize it, beneficial reuse? It is nutrients, and plants do like it. So every milligram that you don't treat, you're saving a carbon footprint. And sustainability is one of the goals of the project. The other thing is, this kind of pond is a bacteria-based prices. The index now is $500 a yard for concrete versus $2 to $4 to move a yard of dirt. So it makes the construction and the capital cost much lower if you don't go conventional. You save a lot of pumps. Then there's also the forgiveness thing. In ponds, you have 25 days of treatment. In conventional, you have 24 hours. So you don't have a lot of time. You can't make a lot of mistakes. You've got to be right on the money all the time. With ponds, they're very slow moving. They change very little because you've got 50 million gallons in there. So that's another important part. The honey monster. You can blend septage from septic tanks into the pond system slowly. Blend it in. 70,000 milligrams per liter septage BOD, so you have to blend it in slowly. That's why the Santa Maria tank won't take them. So that's an important issue. You can use the septage, you don't have biosolids, and you're very sustainable. You have odor control because you have the facultative pond is covered. They have a cover over that, if you remember that one. One of the ponds was covered, and you know, then you have the aeration. So anyway, that's my summary. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Al. Frank Acilio, followed by Lawson Schaller.
Frank Acilio, I have a few questions. When you compared the footprint that's going to be utilized for a pond system, one of you were talking about that. What about the comparison to the carbon footprint that would be narrowed down or have little of a carbon footprint because the amount of energy that would be needed to operate that particular system over a 30-year period or 40-year period. I don't know what number you use to ascertain that. Also, I'd like to know what system seems to have the least overall biosolids, that's least constructive construction cost, the continuing management of that system over a certain amount of time, also whatever period of time you compare, how much it costs for your employees to manage that system. Also, any particular type of products that need to be purchased or anything like that. I'm a little confused also about when there was talked about mitigation for property because of larger footprint. Wouldn't most of property that's being considered that up? Well, today it closed at $124.10 a barrel. So, you know, and the projection is that with China, a global economy with China, India, and all these others, that energy prices will continue to decline too. So that's something to look for the future that, you know, not only for this year, next year, what's it going to cost 5 years from now, 10 years from now, as the system is still operational and doesn't need to be replaced. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lawson Schaller, followed by Mary Fullwood.
Good evening again, Lawson Schaller. I just want to put in my two cents for supporting pond systems. I think utilizing what the natural systems have to offer is a very good thing. The low energy, low solids production. Both of those items have a very volatile future in front of them. I happen to like the word exponential myself, but perhaps not appropriate. But the uncertainty of how solids are going to be accepted even within our state. It's very controversial right now. Back to energy, if we can get a... I know there's a trade-off there, and maybe the finance group could, and maybe already have done some sort of a model that will show the maximum benefit point of when you reach X number of acres, that's the perfect amount to buy based on a certain amount of energy use. And again, forecasting energy is going to be a true shot in the dark, and Frank, previous speaker, made an excellent point on that. Solar panels, wind generation, renewable energy in combination with a low energy system, I think, is a pretty exciting option. I don't know if John Todd's eco machines fit within the pond analysis or if it's on the radar screen. I think it is with the county. Page 4, it said non-aerated ponds not considered feasible for the Los Osos wastewater project. I'm not an engineer. I don't know among the engineers or other experts if that is widely accepted as true. I know it requires a lot more acreage, so it makes sense. Or if that is at all controversial. I mean, is non-aerated completely off the table? The AIPS Woodland Mutual Project, I was curious when that was installed. The report didn't say when it was installed. I think it said you're anticipating solid removal in 20 years. I'm just, you know, if it was done 15 years ago, is there any sort of a gauge on that? And if there's also newer technology, get as many fixed costs as we can on that, and I think that's going to simplify things and create maybe less anxiety for folks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mary Fullwood, followed by Lindy Owen.
My name is Mary Fullwood, and I appreciate your receptiveness to the public comment tonight on both of the TMs. It's been... I really like seeing it. So I am referring to John Waddell's comment that the smaller the acreage, the greater the increase on energy consumption, and that does bring up John Todd. He did present that he's aiming for zero carbon footprints on small acreage, and he is coming back here at the end of May to have a meeting with Rob Miller to discuss the Los Osos project in greater depth. Another advantage to the ponds is, I had the privilege of being able to be in conversation with Rob Miller and John Todd teleconference, and they both brought up the notion that you can do algae sequestering, and one of them said that algae has 40% oil, and it's a more advantageous source than corn as biodiesel, and if I remember correctly, a Cal Poly professor is focusing this. And so there are ways to utilize ponding not only for treatment but to possibly be a revenue for our community that's putting so much money towards a sewer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our last speaker on this is Lindy Owen.
Hi, Lindy Owen. I wondered if you could, I didn't see any information, I didn't get a chance to look at that carefully, but the difference between raw sewage from a conventional gravity versus effluent, I don't know if that was addressed in the overall cost. This is why shopping for roofs at 7 different locations and going in and looking at foundations at 7 other locations confuses issues and doesn't give you a good picture of what a combo of combining best technologies together to come up with a really awesome project could do before you can reuse the water. So could you separate those different costs that should come up? I also just a little thought, something to think about. During an energy shutdown, how well will a conventional treatment plant and collection system work? And I would like that to be a top priority. As energy costs soar, we need to be looking at how we get by with no energy, if that does come down. And my belief is that places like San Luis Obispo and any place that's on a standard conventional gravity sewer, they're not going to be using their homes for bathroom facilities, bathing, washing, anything. Whereas on a septic system or a possible step system with solar, we might be able to have a choice. And I wanted to read out of water efficiency, lots of great information, but it talks about solar power now delivers about 1/4 of the energy that it's the Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District, an example. About 1/4 of the energy that they need for an 8 million gallon per day wastewater treatment plant. Morrison sums up saying, if you have the room to put in solar arrays, do it. It's probably one of the best and most efficient ways to reduce energy problems and grid dependency. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was our last request. I think we had some, again, very good comments from the audience here. Rob, did you have any responses?
I know it's getting late, Mr. Chair. I'll just very briefly say that non-aerated ponds weren't feasible because of very, very large footprint, hundreds of acres. And then I think there's a lot of neat folks in this field. I know the issue of algae production for fuel is not at industrial scale yet, but I'm watching that one closely to see if that, because we have a lot of ponds around here, so a lot of exciting things. And then a lot of these options, they're not standalone, AIPS versus NELS. I mean, some of these have a lot of overlap. So Jonathan Todd and others, they all deal in a lot of the same technologies, core technologies, so it's an option to continue to look at.
Thank you, Rob. Staff?
Yes, I just had one comment that several speakers touched on, and that's energy costs in the O&M operation and maintenance estimates. And, you know, the O&M costs were estimated in the fine screening report, and, you know, I've been revisited in some of these tech memos, but we are working to develop an even 5 times the rate of inflation, or 1.5 times or 3 times. And so, you know, that is a variable that we have, you know, definitely identified to flag for that kind of adjustment and looking at the sensitivity analysis of energy costs over the life of the project.
Thank you very much. Did we have any speaker slips for general public comment? Okay, we'll go to general public comment. But I would like to let everyone know that although we haven't answered all the questions that were brought up in your comments, the person who is taking lots of notes there at the staff table, I'm sure a lot of that will be discussed in their meetings as appropriate. Okay, well, we have 4 requests for general public comment. So let's, again, if you don't need all your time, we appreciate that. We'll start with Mark Lowe. Is he still here? No? Okay. It's going to be Gail McPherson, followed by Al Barrow, and finally Alan Perlman. So, Gail, kick it off for us.
Oh, it's getting late. I just wanted to make sure that you all have this. It's the Wastewater and Water Design Build Conference at Cal Poly on Saturday. There's also a welcome reception in networking at Etna Valley Winery Friday evening from 5 to 7:30. You're all invited to that if you'd like to come and network. If you want to attend the workshop, you need to go online and get registered. And I've sent that around. I think you guys have the website and all the information on that. An important book is hot off the presses, and it's going to be part of the seminar package, along with case studies and lots of good information, including the legal and the financial issues. That's the Municipal Water and Wastewater Design Build Handbook. It's like I say, hot off the press, and it's from the Water Design Build Council. And so I hope to see you there, and we're also videotaping, and we'll have DVDs available and packages of the materials, if you can't attend, available for purchase. So I sure hope the county will support you guys in attending and pay your registration.
So I haven't used drinking water to flush my toilet now for some time, and I don't use gray water, so what do? I take my water, the gray water from the sink and the shower, and put it in a compost barrel, compost tea barrel, and for $20 you can get a little aerator for fish tanks. And it has two little tubes that go down there that are weighted down there, and it aerates that. I have a little wastewater treatment system right there, and after a couple of days, the gray becomes clear, what they call tea. And I add some bacteria, like you could get Dr. Earth boxes over at Los Osos Valley Nursery, and you can utilize all that water over again. It's really fun. And most of that water ends up in my garden. So it's really a joyful experience being able to do things like Brock Dolman advised us, do it right on site as much as you can. There's a lot of things that we can do, so that's exciting. That's one of the things. $20 up at the pet store for a little pump. 30-gallon container, not a problem. So the other thing is solar. I think solar is a capital investment that you have to consider seriously. But if you put in $1 million worth of solar panels out there, no matter what kind of treatment that you do, you're going to get the free energy from the sun. And over time, that sustainable technology will more than pay for itself. We'll reduce our community's carbon footprint. And let's don't forget about AB32 is a greenhouse gas. And we want to see if we can comply as a community. And we can even put little small solar panels on our roofs to run little systems like step pumps and things like that. And the other thing we can do is we can encourage everybody to get a solar panel for their home. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Alan Perlman and Alan, try to keep it to tech issues, though. But you can't announce the election.
Oh, fellow, can't we? Actually, before you start my time, since you did start that way, we are fellow LOCAC members. I do appreciate your guidance, not necessarily on specific issues, but on how to approach a county. I've been also a land use committee member for quite a few years, and that guidance helped me, and I appreciate your time. And I would call it even mentoring. I wanted to say that as a prelude, and I chose not to speak during ponds. All I want to say about that, ponds are good. One more thing about Broderson. Broderson is directly above the Tri-W site. That site is now receiving is planned to receive increased flows of stormwater, and that is a consideration because it is hydrologically beneath Broderson. So saturation of the area under, even though it goes down, it also goes laterally, gravity flows, and so forth. So there is a concern there as to the increase due to construction of a real stormwater drainage system onto the Tri-W property due to the Palisades project. But what I really want to tell you is about the RWQCB. Growth is going to be affected in four counties. It does directly affect the TAC work in that new regulations are going to affect growth in Los Osos in areas outside the prohibition zone, and that may raise the incentive level for participation in a wastewater project from outside the prohibition zone. At the same time, and I'm quite concerned about this, I believe some of these regulations, besides being very costly, I think it's going to bankrupt our California economy, actually, but the other concern is it might actually stilt growth because I believe board member Shellcross, RWQCB member Shellcross, noted that if the counties can't find place to put their septage, maybe they shouldn't build. And if that has implications right there. But other than that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Alon. Lindy Owen is our last speaker.
Thank you. I think Frank was also requesting a chance. I wanted to basically speak to the fact that I really request that you begin looking at a holistic approach and break out of the pattern that has been going on, because I just don't think we're going to get there without wasting a ton of time, money, and making a lot of mistakes on the way. A holistic approach is, one, what is going to happen to the trees and landscaping in this beautiful town of ours when they have no septic leach water coming into them? We're going to get there through this process. I can tell you right now, if it weren't for so many people coming up and demanding that we look at sustainability and we look at long-term, long-range planning, I don't think this process would have gotten us anywhere close to what would be the best system for our community and for other communities to look at. We're an experiment in the making. Again, one thing that we haven't talked about, my vision was to have the low-lying area collected with a step collection system run in, outside of town below the cemetery and possibly even have a created wetlands down there, but have the Nelson Pond works best for me. But I also envisioned having three large windmills, the slow-moving type. If we were considering spending $200 million to create the mess that was going to be created over there, how about if we came up with a $75 million plant design or collection design, and we spent $50 million putting in three beautiful, tall, slow-moving windmills that could actually run, be fed right into the grid, get credit to actually run part of our town, run our complete system. We can run the purple pipe is then just the cost of installation, the energy to push it back in and reuse it. I think our build-out could even go higher. If anybody wants to think out of the box a little bit, let's think about how we spend our money and what we're getting for it. And let's do things differently than we tried to do it this last time. Thank you.
Thank you. Frank?
Thank you. Frank Casilio. I'd like to talk about the technical memorandum from last month about the water import, and I know that it wasn't acceptable, seemed like the community wasn't acceptable to have an import water. But I had some questions. First of all, that there were some figures thrown out by the TAC about the cost per month, what it would cost per month additional. Somebody calculated figures real quickly, $30 to $40 per month additional cost. My concern is that some of those figures were incorrect that were in the tech manual, because when it said $1,180 acre foot for water, it would cost us state water. Actually, Morro Bay pays $1,450 per acre foot, so I doubt if we would be paying less. Also, it did say in the tech manual, it was real clear, there are construction cost estimates only and do not include permits cost, CEQA cost, design cost, and other project implement. Also, it said that it wasn't, it's up to the water purveyors to deal with the issue of, to consider, let's see, it remains an option for future consideration by Los Osos community water purveyors for solving the current basin overdrafts. Actually, AB 2701, that's what's posted up there. If you look at section C, you'll see where it does say the county may take necessary steps to construct, operate a community wastewater collection and treatment system to meet the wastewater collection and treatment needs within the district. The county has chosen only to deal with the prohibition zone, though it does have the authority for the whole district. This effort may include programs and projects for recharging aquifer, prevent saltwater intrusion, and the management of groundwater resources to the extent they are related to the construction operation of the community wastewater collection and treatment system. And when I was up in Sacramento on that, I don't remember water purveyors being brought into the issue. They saw this in Sacramento as a community-wide issue. Everybody who uses water in the basin, not only those who have water purveyors, but those people who have wells. So we're looking at the legislators who are saying, yeah, this is a community-wide issue, and I keep hearing here it's a purveyor's issue problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If I could just touch on those comments real quick.
Yes.
Just looking at that, I noticed that it says that anything that's connected to the wastewater system, and as far as direct injection, I think that would be more connected to the wastewater system than looking at imported water would be.
Thank you. And with that, I'm sorry for the overrun tonight, but I think we had a very good meeting. Got a lot of good information. Thank all you folks who came, and all you folks at home who are still watching. We appreciate comments. See you in June. Our next meeting is June 9, the second Monday of June.